And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Join me right now, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. Matthew has been writing, editing, and teaching on a variety of topics relating to church history, the papacy, the saints, Catholic culture. He's faculty chair at Catholic Distance University, a senior fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and vice president and editorial director of EWTN News. He hosts Register Radio, which airs Saturdays at 4 in the afternoon and Sundays at 11 in the morning. Matthew, good to have you back here. Thanks.
Oh, always a privilege to be with you. A very happy Easter to everyone. Yeah. And also a joyous feast of St. Isidore of Sevilla.
Yes, that's right.
Doctor of the Church.
Yeah. Again, tell us a little bit about why Isidore of Seville is regarded as a doctor of the Church.
Yeah, well, it's one of those questions that we often ask about how anyone ends up a doctor of the Church. We've got some like Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, absolutely no-brainer as to why they're doctors of the Church. But then we also have someone like Teresa of Lisieux, who was named a doctor of the Church by Pope St. John Paul II. And the question at the time was asked, well, what possibly makes her a doctor of the Church? So he issued a whole letter. It's called The Science of Divine Love, explaining why. And in the case of Isidore, he's considered the last great scholar of the ancient world.
Okay.
And he lived in the early 7th century. And we can say of him that aside from the fact that he was a bishop, he was a great reformer. He was also one of the smartest men in the history of the Church.
Yeah.
So he was basically considered the first Christian author to bring together the sum of universal knowledge, the etymologiae, that was kind of an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
So not only is he the patron, unofficial patron of the internet, he's also something very important to me. One of the reasons that he first became very important to me is, as you know, I've written a lot of encyclopedias over the years.
Yes.
Sort of the patron saint of encyclopedias.
That's right. No, he was a giant in that regard, and very highly respected as one of the great scholars of late antiquity in the early Middle Ages. Well, let's go to another story here that has some intrigue to it. So we have Pope Francis cooperating in a book, a new Spanish language book called The Successor, My Memories of Benedict XVI. And in this book, he actually says that he was used in the 2005 conclave in an effort to block the election of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, even while he supported the election of Joseph Ratzinger.
Yes. Yeah. And there's, as you say, there's a lot to unpack in this.
Yeah.
Up to and including, as is the case now, especially in social media, a lot of people saying, well, does he have the right to reveal the secrets of the conclave?
That's right.
And the short answer, and I would encourage everyone to read Father Raymond D'Souza's great analysis piece on this at the National Catholic Register.
It is very good. Yes.
It is, but he makes the point, basically, as supreme lawgiver, yes, he can do this if he wishes.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that somehow, as Pope, he can't speak of the conclave that elected him. Now, he, as is technically pointed out, did take the oath of secrecy, but as Pope, he can set that aside. And I think he's doing so for a couple of reasons. The first is that we continue to see concerns from both the right and the left, and, you know, I always hate to use political terms, labels like that, but that he is somehow a candidate of rupture, that he is somebody who is distancing himself from Pope Benedict, that he's distancing himself from the continuity of church teaching.
Right.
And
right.
I think Pope Francis wants to make a point here that he does, in fact, serve in continuity with his predecessors. And that's a point that he's tried to make, and I think he's returning to this theme twofold. One, that he was in favor of the candidacy of Pope Benedict. And if you're okay, I'd love to come back to that in a second.
Yeah, sure.
But the other is the fact that there were those who wanted to use him, as he puts it, to block the candidacy of Joseph Ratzinger to be elected Pope. Now, we know based on hints and other information, that there was a group that was determined as best they could to prevent Benedict's election in 2005 after the death of Pope John Paul II. They seem to have gravitated initially, based on reports, around Carlo Cardinal Martini, who essentially would have none of it. And so they moved on to another candidate and apparently decided that Bergoglio was their man. And according to Pope Francis, he did not approve of this because he didn't want to be used as their candidate simply to block the election of someone else, in mm-hmm. this case, the candidate that he apparently supported.
Yeah, yeah. So he's trying to retain or reestablish in the mind of Catholics his continuity with Benedict. He seems, I don't know if it's fair to say, he seems afraid that he'll be regarded as a pope of rupture. In spite of the fact that he said he likes messing things up.
yes, hug on Leo. yeah,
he doesn't want that to be the last word.
right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. And now, to go back to his support of the candidacy, one of the observations that he has made is that he recognized that Joseph Ratzinger, and this was much commented at, even at the time, was the perfect choice to succeed Pope John Paul II
mm-hmm.
for two reasons, as he notes. One is that he was the likely successor. He's the one that everyone knew. But Francis is also making the point that were he to have been elected in 2005, he would have been the very figure that he is now. And he feels clearly that that would not have been suitable or feasible in light of the 25-year pontificate that had just preceded it, so yeah. that Pope Benedict becomes a kind of transitional figure. And that's not unheard of either in the history of the papacy, where you do have older cardinals who have historically been elected after long pontificates, and the term that they always give is a papa di passaggio, a passing pope, in other words, a transitional pope. Now, you never know what you're going to end up with.
John the 23rd.
John the 23rd. I think, too, of Leo the 13th.
Yes, that's right. That is right.
Pius the 9th was Gioacchino Pecci, was supposed to be old, frail. He wouldn't be around for very long. All he did was reign for 25 more years after this, which is technically the longest pontificate in history of Pius the 9th. And essentially buried everyone who ever voted for him. So, again, you have to be careful not to try to second-guess the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I guess a lot of us would like to know, did he hint, did he take the fingerprints of those who were manipulating him? Do we know, did he identify them?
Well, I think it's pretty clear which group was trying to back him. We hear constant rumors of who they might have been in that particular conclave. This is a group that, having failed in 2005, seemed to have redoubled their efforts in 2013. We know that Pope Francis has talked about the fact that there was a group of cardinals that came to him early on in the preparation and then the conclave itself in 2013 and peppered him, as he puts it, with many, many questions about liberation theology, in a way taking the measure of him. He claims that that was a group that then seemed to have settled on him. I'm not sure if that would be the same group, however, that had already decided on him going into the conclave.
Yeah.
But again, that stress on continuity, and he goes further in this new book, talking about the way that the two of them had such a good relationship. And that, as he put it, he writes in his book that he left me free. He never interfered. On one occasion when there was a decision he didn't understand, he asked me for an explanation in a very natural way. He said, look, I don't understand, but the decision is in your hands. So it's an interesting twofold aspect that one he tried to cultivate and had a good working relationship with his predecessor under what were very unusual circumstances of a papal resignation.
Right.
One of the things that we do hear consistently is that Benedict was always deferential and understood perfectly well. He would, more than anyone in the church, the importance of obedience to the one who was rightly elected as his successor.
Yeah.
And Benedict was a true man of the church in that regard.
And also, Pope Francis says that Benedict XVI defended him in the face of accusations that he was a promoter of same-sex so-called marriage.
That's right. And we'll have to see what that actually pans out to be.
Right.
It's this idea of defending him as duly elected pope. And there's a long paragraph where he talks about that he listened to the argument, and he makes the point that Benedict didn't get agitated because he knew perfectly well what I think he said.
Yeah.
And he cited the formula of civil unions in France and other things. But when those people, when many came to Benedict to complain about what at least as Francis would interpret it, his take on all of this was Benedict defended him. And I think that's something that Pope Francis definitely appreciated. He did also have some tart comments about some of the books that came out at the time of Pope Benedict's death. And the name, of course, that circulated in that discussion is Archbishop Georg Gainswein, the former secretary of Pope Benedict and, for a time, Pope Francis himself. So Pope Francis is willing to call out certain people in a way that he thinks are worthy of criticism. But I think it's how much control one has in many ways over when books get published is something else, as you know.
Very good. Hold it there. Matthew will come back and continue conversation. There are many other stories to discuss that are of interest among Catholics. And I mentioned Orthodox Patriarch Bartholomew, the Ecumenical Patriarch, the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch of Constantinople, hopes for a unified date for Easter. That's big news. Good afternoon. I'm Al Creston. With me is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, talking about some news of interest to Catholics picked up from all around the world. And one story that is circulating right now is that the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch of Constantinople has expressed a desire that Christians in the East and West begin celebrating Easter on a unified date rather than adhere to separate Lenten calendars. And there's a long story behind this, by the way. And it's been a sore spot between the Christian East and the Christian West. It has to do with the use of what calendar you're using. The Protestant churches of the Christian West eventually adopted the Gregorian calendar at various later stages, and the Catholic Church, after the Gregorian reform of the calendar in 1582, the Catholic Church decided to compute the date of Easter, but the resulting date differed from that computed using the Julian calendar. And if you sense that this is confusing, you're right. It is confusing. And so the Eastern Orthodox and the majority of the Christianese continued the older practice of aligned to the Julian calendar, as I understand it.
That's right.
So talk to me about how this became a problem.
Well, this became a problem in part because there were chronic challenges to the calendar because of the Julian calendar. Now, for the Julian calendar, we're talking about a calendar that was developed by Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
That would wonderfully effective. The problem is that there were issues with it, that because of the passage of time, you had days that were added. I will leave it to the experts in the how we calculate calendars and things to get into the details of that. But at the heart of it was that there were some inefficiencies that did not fully reflect the passage of the sun and the earth and everything else, so that the days were becoming an issue. And it fell to the church to fix it. And the result was the Gregorian calendar introduced by Pope Gregory the 13th. I think there was I wrote an article many years ago, I think it was for the This Rock magazine, on the day that the church changed time.
Yeah.
Because we did. We solved these problems with the Gregorian calendar.
We built an observatory, too, to help us in this, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. So this idea that somehow the church is anti-science. The calendar that we use today is courtesy of Pope Gregory the 13th, who spearheaded an effort to fix the calendar and prevented. By now, we would be looking at even greater chaos than we were facing. However, it took a little while for the Gregorian calendar to be accepted, certainly even among Protestant countries, because this was introduced in the 16th century at a time when, let's just say, there wasn't a lot of good relations between the Catholics and Protestants. So they eventually recognized that the sheer scientific precision of the Gregorian calendar.
Yeah.
The problem was that we still had our separated Orthodox sisters and brothers who adhered to the Julian calendar. And so that's a calendar that I said dates back to Julius Caesar, all the way in 45 BC. Now, that meant that the Julian calendar has a very different set of dates. And now, if you're using the calendars to calculate when Easter takes place, you can see where this is headed, that there are going to be differences in the liturgical calendars. Now, the liturgical calendars remained based on the Julian calendar for a number of more centuries. Now, my understanding is that most Orthodox churches adopted a revised version, but there are still some, including the Patriarchate of Moscow, I believe, that still follow the old Julian calendar.
Yeah.
You actually have some differences there as well. And so this idea is that the Orthodox and Catholics would have a settled date for Easter every year, partly aided by, I believe, that next year, Orthodox Easter, at least for the for most of the Orthodox churches, and our Easter fall on the same day, which is April 20th of 2025, which is a big deal.
Yeah. Give us a chance to worship together. Of course, Easter is the high point of the liturgical calendar. We'd be all on the same page. This interest, this initiative, is from the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, and there has been traditionally competition, maybe, between Constantinople and Moscow. Do you know what the Patriarch of Moscow thinks of this initiative?
Well, you said something that's really important, that Bartholomew is the Ecumenical Patriarch of the Patriarchate of Constantinople, which is an ancient and venerable patriarchate in the Orthodox Church. He is considered primus inter pares. He's sort of first among equals. But we also recognize that the Orthodox Patriarchate of Moscow, which is, I believe, the largest of the Orthodox churches, has very poor relations, especially now, with the Patriarchate of Constantinople. So the assumption is that the Moscow Patriarchate, currently occupied as Patriarch Kirill, would probably reject an effort to bring together the two calendars, in large measure because it would require a revision of the calendar, something that, at least so far, my understanding is, I could be incorrect, but my understanding is that that's something that the Moscow Patriarchate would likely not be in favor of doing. So we could end up with further divisions. Now, even on the question of the dating of Easter within the Orthodox churches. But one thing, too, that's significant is that 2025 is shaping up as a notable time for ecumenical relations, especially with the Orthodox, for these two reasons. One, we have the coming together of the date of Easter, but we also have the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. And that'll be next year. So that, I think, is going to be a major opportunity for real ecumenical outreach, certainly with the ecumenical patriarch. He already is a very good friend of Francis. I would think that next year we're going to see some important marking of that date. We already know, for example, that Francis has proclaimed a jubilee, and I think this will be part of it, given the importance of the Council of Nicaea in the history of the church.
Yeah, no, that's something to keep our eyes on, because it could have real serious implications for the future unity of the faith. I did want to ask you about this story that is going around, that the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith has a new document called Dignitas Infinita, Infinite Dignity, on Human Dignity. It's going to be debuted at a press conference in Rome on April 8th. What do we know about this?
Yes, this has been sort of hat-tipped. This has been anticipated now for a couple of months, and I say that because we know that in the aftermath of Fiducia Supplicans, which your viewers listeners will remember, this is the document from the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith drafted by its prefect, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, that allows non-liturgical blessings of same-sex couples and couples in irregular situations, that he, in the wake of the strong reaction to Fiducia, which you and I have spoken many times, that there was going to be a document coming out on what we're assuming will be human dignity, that's also going to touch on contemporary moral issues, in particular surrogacy, of which Pope Francis has spoken very strongly, and gender ideology, of which Pope Francis has also spoken very strongly. And Cardinal Fernandez has reportedly have said that this is a document that will make the people who are complaining about Fiducia Supplicans very happy, because it is a very clear reiteration, I think, of what the church teaches. In particular, though, focused as he is on what is now being called the contemporary magisterium, focusing as he does on the teachings and writings of Pope Francis, that if we just look at those, this document is likely to be a very strong, barring a surprise, a very strong condemnation of surrogacy, of gender ideology, and so many of the situations that we're finding ourselves now in terms of social change and sex change, surgeries, surrogacy, and other things.
Do you know how concrete it will be? Right now, we've got people calling for changes in Catholic anthropology.
Yeah.
And they usually talk in with a lot of abstract nouns and passive verbs, and just and nobody knows what the heck they're saying. I would hope this document would be, you know, down to earth in terms of questions that people have, and you know, something that will be understandable.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a key point in this, and that is, what is the framing going to be for this theologically? And from a standpoint of Christian anthropology and Catholic moral teaching, when we're talking about the infinite dignity, in other words, a document on human dignity, are we talking about natural law? Are we talking about made in the image and likeness of God?
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about? Because we have already seen, and this is even part of the study groups that have been established by Pope Francis, but we've also seen a number of very prominent leaders in the church speak openly about the need to embrace the new social sciences, the sociological understanding of the human person, in light of cultural and social advances. Now, that is potentially toxic from a Catholic standpoint, as you know, because it erodes our understanding of what human dignity is and our approach to the human person. And so I think this is the big question that we'll have answered, hopefully, on Monday when this document is rolled out.
All right. Matthew, hold it. We've got to take a break, and we'll come back and continue conversation. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, guiding us in a discussion of a wide range of issues that are of interest to Catholics. I'm Al Cresta. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and I was happy to see, what really started years ago. I remember when Maggie Gallagher was on this program talking to us about the beginning of the Benedict XVI Institute for Sacred Music and Divine Worship and the leadership role that Archbishop Coeur de Lion had taken. And one of the masses commissioned by the Benedict XVI Institute for Sacred Music and Divine Worship has done pretty well on the Billboard charts. What can you tell me about this?
Yeah, well, this is one of those classic moments, I think, where we have the joy of watching something come together as beautifully as this has. And what I mean by that is that we have an institute, as you noted, that really was intended to help people appreciate and understand the beauty of the church's liturgical tradition. And here we have this great progress. In this case, we have a mass that was designed and intended to bring about a real renaissance in Catholic music. And I think that's one of the things that makes this so important. Oh, so we have this, the Requiem for the Forgotten, which is, I believe it's composed by Frank LaRocca.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a mass honoring Our Lady of Lourdes, the Messe de Malade. And it's apparently done extremely well during Holy Week. For the actual Billboard, which, of course, is the listing for music. And it has just sort of skyrocketed, which tells you that a lot of people are listening to this. It comes on the heels of the Mass of the Americas that debuted also, I think, phenomenally well on the Billboard chart. Was it a couple of years ago? I think it was September of 2022. And Frank LaRocca is the composer in residence at the Benedict XVI Institute. And it's this idea, again, of if you create beautiful art, beautiful liturgy, beautiful liturgical music, people really do respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Archbishop Coeur de Lion, the Archbishop of San Francisco, put it well. He said, what is classically Catholic works.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think this is very important to also recognize that they have a composer in residence, and they're supporting him.
Yes.
I mean, people, when they think of creative individuals, they think of the artist working alone in his attic and having to beg at bars in the evening in order to eat and drink. But in this case, they have gone ahead and they've brought this this man, Frank LaRocca, in and supporting him. He is incredibly competent. I mean, his background, he studied at Yale and at the University of California, Berkeley. He began composing at age 14. He's been around a while, and he is seems to be just fulfilled with praise for the opportunity to do what he's doing now. And I wish him long life and fruitful creative ventures. I have not heard this mass, but
No, neither have I.
Yeah.
What's also important to consider is, as you note, this is a composer in residence. In other words, this is somebody who is given the freedom, the latitude to compose.
Yep.
You said it right. Historically, artists and composers can be starving in search of patrons. And historically, some great artists have had pretty phenomenal patrons. I think of Michelangelo.
Yes.
Or Leonardo da Vinci. Or even, for that matter, Mozart. But even Mozart struggled.
Yeah, he did.
Yes, so you can have the greatest of talent, but not necessarily an appreciating audience. And in this case, I think here we have, because of this institute, the opportunity for a brilliant composer to do what he does best. But also the issue of what we're talking about in terms of the Requiem for the Forgotten, this new hymn in honor of who? The martyrs of Soviet communism.
Mm.
And this is also part of this project on the martyrs of communism. And I think that has great and important merit just on its own sense.
Yes.
Because we live in an era now, I was watching just today, the gatherings of young people in different venues celebrating the glories of communism.
Yeah.
And proposing Marxism as a solution to all of our social ills. And when we can remember and do our part to honor the victims of communism, the 100 million or so who died just in the 20th century at the hands of communism, this type of a requiem, this sort of a project, as I was saying, assumes even more importance.
Yeah, very much so. And this becomes increasingly important, too, as China occupies a larger and larger footprint on the planet. So hopefully this will get widespread play and coverage, and the focus on the martyrs of communism will be educational at the very least. I have to say, I do not get, I don't get even young people showing sympathy for communism. You know, that they have to blind themselves to a history of violence which has been integral to the establishment of communism, wherever it goes. It's, people die.
Well, you're absolutely right. The challenge, though, becomes when we have entire school districts, we have school curricula, we have individual teachers, we have college professors. We have television programs. We have book authors. We have TikTok that will, as you know, be an avenue of propaganda for socialism, for communism, for gender ideology. Unfortunately, this is the byproduct of a real process and program of indoctrination. And this is the result in many ways of the march to the institutions that we saw and have been lamenting for decades now, and we are truly seeing the fruits of it.
Yeah.
So anything that we can do to counteract that, to get the truth out, is important.
Amen. Here's a strange story. I don't know what you have on it, but the Archdiocese of Vancouver signed a, quote, sacred covenant with First Nation in British Columbia. What can you tell me about that? And then I want to ask, I mean, what is the nature of a sacred covenant in this context?
Yeah, well, what you're referring to is a pact, basically an agreement of sorts that was signed, as you note, by the Archdiocese of Vancouver under its Archbishop J. Michael Miller. I would add very quickly that Archbishop Miller has never been considered any sort of a progressive archbishop, quite
right.
The opposite.
He did the introductions for the encyclicals of John Paul II, didn't he? That our Sunday Visitor
published. I was just about to
say
that very thing. Yes, yes.
They're spectacular.
And Maine, I think, absolutely, yeah. But that's the word for it. Spectacular introductions to these encyclicals. And anyone who, I'm sure you can still find copies, buy that book just for the introduction.
Yeah.
Because of the depth of scholarship.
Yeah, no, I agree.
He's been the Archbishop of Vancouver for quite a number of years. And essentially what they're doing is a kind of covenant that is an agreement of sorts that really is intended to, as he puts it, forge a relationship between the indigenous tribes or the native tribes and the church. And it's the tribes of Kamloops. I won't even try to pronounce, I will butcher the name of the indigenous tribes. But the point being that I think this is an opportunity for the church in Kamloops and in Vancouver and in Canada and in North America to rebuild some of the relationship that historically was there that I think has been damaged in recent years, partly because of the recognition of historical mistakes and abuses that took place, but also partly, I think, because of the fallout that continues for what was believed to have been the discovery of a huge unmarked grave site at the Indian Residential School in British Columbia that was in Kamloops. Now, the claim at the time was that they had found hundreds of unmarked graves of children at the school site. Now, we know that, my understanding is that to date, we have yet to uncover any actual remains,
right.
Which, and yet there's been no apology from anyone in terms of the treatment of the church as a result of what are apparently unfounded accusations. No remains have been found at this excavation. And nevertheless, it was the occasion for a set of apologies, including a very memorable visit by Pope Francis to Canada, I think in 2022, and the wholesale criticism of the Catholic Church for the residential school system. And certainly terrible things happened. And as the Archbishop said, that it is time for regret and expressions of sorrow for the tragedies, as he put it, quote, that flowed from the residential school system.
Yeah. In the absence of the bodies, he's relying on first-person testimony, I assume.
Yes. Well, we know that the system itself has been the source of great controversy in recent years. We know that well over, 150,000 children attended the various schools. The estimates are that about 4,000 are believed to have died. At least that's according to the Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Mm-hmm.
The main criticisms, I think, have focused around the questions of how much indoctrination took place and how much of forced assimilation into Canadian society at the time. Now, let's be clear that the church has apologized for all of that, but at the same time, it was not exclusive to the church. We had Protestants who were brought in also to run schools. As far as the Canadian government at the time was concerned, it made sense to have the churches do it, in part because that's what they do anyway in terms of education and care for Indigenous peoples. That's been recognized, certainly the church's role in caring for and protecting the rights of Native Americans in North America and beyond. And the Canadian government didn't want to spend the money. And so we do have apologies, for example, from the Canadian Prime Minister, but obviously there's a lot more that needs to be understood about all of this, including why these accusations remain unproven.
Very good. We don't have time, but there's something wonderfully ironic about atheist Richard Dawkins now saying that he considers himself a cultural Christian, even though he's not believing, and he thinks it would be truly dreadful if we substituted any alternative religion.